A man on a mission with a plan to expand my vision. Yeah, it's either this or it's prison. I'm trying to be free and expand my wisdom. I gotta tell my story. I did it for the journey, the glory. Many men tried way before me. I had to do it bigger cause I had to make history.
Hello and welcome to Ocean Research Project. I am Matt Rutherford, back in Maryland, sitting on the Alt on my boat, dealing with heartburn. I don't know what it is about heartburn. It certainly seems to happen more and more the older you get. I don't know how people used to, like, go through life before, you know, Tums were around. Like, people must have, you know, just like after the age of 50, there must have been a bunch of people with, like, heartburn, like, all day, every day. You know, I mean, it's like glasses, you know, like how did people deal with life before glasses were around? You know, I mean, I have people say, oh, yeah, people got to wear glasses because they stare at computer screens all day and people didn't used to stare at computer screens. Man, people were wearing glasses, you know, back in the time of like World War II and World War I. There weren't any computers around at all back then. I don't think you can blame, I mean, computers don't help, but I don't think computers make it worse. And anyways, I don't know. It's the older you get, the more heartburn you get. And I got some right now. But anyways, I'm thinking about selling St. Brendan, the boat that I took around the Americas, the 27-foot Alban Vega. I've been back and forth about what to do about this boat for some time. When I left on that trip around the Americas, I didn't own that boat. The boat was owned by Crab, the organization I was raising money for. And the board of directors freaked out when I was in the Arctic and signed the boat into my name, which I really wasn't very happy about. I didn't know about it until I got back to Maryland. At the end of the trip, you know, I get back. The day I get back, I step foot on land. There's this whole thing with Gary Jobson and the governor and Don Backe and blah, blah, blah. And after that little time on stage, we go and I go to have my first meal, which I had ribs and beer and Guinness. I think it was ribs and Guinness was the first thing I had. And anyways, I say to Don, hey, Don, why don't we auction this boat off? And, you know, we'll raise a little more extra money for the organization. And he says, well, we don't own the boat. You own the boat. What do you mean? I don't own the boat. What are you talking about? I already got a 323 Pearson, which is beat to death. You know, well, it wasn't beat to death, but, you know, I had done that two single-handed transatlantics, that whole Europe, Africa, Caribbean trip, and I hadn't done a refit to it since. And so it was definitely tired. And so, yeah, I'm like, I don't know my boat. What are you talking about? And he's like, yeah, well, the board of directors freaked out when you were in the Northwest Passage, and they signed the boat over to your name. You can't just sign a boat over to somebody's name. Like, I can't, like, take my car and put it in your name. You have to sign the documentation. You have to sign the title, which means that somebody forged my signature, which is illegal. And it's like I'm raising money for this nonprofit organization, and the way that the board of directors is thanking me is by illegally signing a title into my name, so they don't have any responsibility if I sink and die. They can, like, distance themselves from me. Really, really pissed me off. I went in to talk to the board of directors after that trip, and they thought I was going to come in with all, you know, smiles and rainbows, and I ended up reading them the Riot Act, which I think they were all a bit surprised. But, you know, they never were very helpful anyways, for the most part. When I went to do that trip, Don Backe, the executive director of Crab, was all about it. You know, he was my guy helping out. And the board of directors try to convince him, at least certain members, try to convince him that not to do the trip. They're telling him, oh, this is crazy. You're just going to get him killed. This is going to be awful for Crab, blah, 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 blah. And they're trying to talk him out of it. And then one board member, Art Savage, I think his name is Art, after I went around Cape Horn, he got up off his butt, thankfully, and talked to a PR company, and the PR company offered to sponsor a good deal of PR. But they waited till I went through the Northwest Passage and got around Cape Horn before they started this process. Because by then, they figured, I guess, oh, he made it past all the worst. He's going to make it back now. You know, all the hard parts were behind me. And so at that point, it was a lot easier to convince people to get behind the cause now that the majority of the hard work had already been done and the dangerous places were already over. Of course, anywhere in the ocean can be dangerous. But anyways, I got this boat, St. Brendan, in my name, and I was kind of pissed. I was like, well, what am I supposed to do with it? This boat is broken. Like, now I have two broken boats. Like, it's hard enough to have one broken boat. And so I tried to donate it to museums, you know, and I couldn't find a museum that would take it. Nobody around Annapolis would take it. And I talked to a couple other ones, like one in St. Michael's and down in Norfolk. And basically what they told me is this boat is another mouth to feed. So if I give them that my boat, I've also got to give them money to support the boat. Now, I do understand that every single, you know, thing in a museum that's going to be displayed is going to cost the museum some money to display it. I mean, that makes sense. But you telling me you want me to give you my boat and give you money? Well, you out of your effing mind? You know, I mean, I'm broke and I got a nonprofit I got to raise money for. I'm barely raising money for my own organization. You want me to raise money for your organization and give you my boat? Which, of course, you know, no way in hell I was going to do that. So, I put it up for sale for a while, and I had a lot of people call me and email me, lots, like, I don't know, 30, 40 people, and I kept talking people out of it. After a while, I'm like, this is silly, man. I mean, you know, you're just talking people up. You know, why you've got this boat for sale if you keep talking people out of buying it? And, I had a lot of emotional attachments to that boat. I still do. And so the biggest problem, hold on, I freaking heartburn. Ah. So the biggest problem was that the engine was broken and needed to be replaced. The engine for that boat is worth more than that boat. So it's a difficult expense to justify. And eventually, just this last spring, I bought a Yanmar 2GM20. With 400 hours, which is nothing, 400 hours. And I know the boat it came off of. He's a well-known racer. I know he takes good care of his stuff. So it's, you know, it's a good 2GM20, which is exactly what that boat should have. And I thought, well, now I got an engine, you know, I can fix St. Brendan up. But it's just been one thing after another, and I haven't had the time. I haven't had the money, because it's going to be another... You know, the boat needs some work. And there's no doubt, you know, the inside of the boat needs a bit of woodwork. The wiring needs to be dealt with. The sails are still in good shape. The rig is still fine. You can sail around the Chesapeake Bay. I mean, if you were to sail around the world, I would change the rigging because there's 27,000 miles on the rigging. But it's in perfectly fine condition for sailing around in the Chesapeake Bay or... you know, coastal cruising or something like that. There's nothing wrong with it. And the sails are still fine. So anyways, I'd be willing to sell St. Brendan. It is a project, and you'd have to want to take on a project with the Yanmar and the Monitor wind vane for $7,000. I'll sell it for $5,000 without the Monitor wind vane. And, that engine cost me $3,000. I just paid $3,000 for that engine back in the spring. I'm not going to really break out. That Monitor wind vane was $4,000 if you buy it brand new, and I got the rebuild kit, which I think I put 50,000 miles on that Monitor wind vane, and it still works like a champ, but it probably could use some new bushings and bearings, but I have that whole kit for it. So anybody, if anybody wants to restore a piece of history, I mean, that boat is historical. It does belong in a museum, but I couldn't find a museum that would take it without me wanting to give them a bunch of money. And however much I would love to restore that boat, I just can't. You know, I just don't have the time or the money. And So anyways, if anybody's interested, you know, just shoot me an email, matt@davidwaltersyachtsales.com. And I'm also thinking about selling my 42-foot steel schooner. I'm trying to think about selling everything and buying a different type of boat. I don't know. I haven't quite gone all the way with this idea. I mean, it's kind of crazy. You know, Nicole was telling me this the other day. It's kind of crazy to sell this boat right now because, you know, winter is right around the corner, and I've got like $10,000 worth of heating systems in this boat. More than half of that are the two S-bar heaters I installed. And I got a wood-burning stove, one of those sardines. If you want to see a really cool marine wood-burning stove, Google marine stove sardine. I think the other one's called a little cod. Yeah, I think that's the next size up. They're expensive as hell. I think with all the pipe work and everything, it was like $2,000. But they're the coolest little thing. I just like wood-burning stoves on a boat. I just like wood-burning stoves, period. I like something about, you know, making a little fire to keep you warm. I don't know. There's something about that I really like. And so, yeah, it makes this boat makes a really, really good liveaboard. And, you know, so it's sort of crazy to think about selling it with winter around the corner. But, you know, we've got another boat to use up in the Arctic the next couple of years. That we'll be leasing for pretty much next to nothing. Some guy is more or less donating it for a couple of years so we can use it up in the Arctic. And, you know, I'm sort of thinking about switching over to something with a Marconi rig and something a little more standard, you know, aft cockpit, Marconi rig, cutter or something like that. Just something that's a little more, that's a little easier to take out for the day, you know. So yeah, I don't know if, you know, it's pretty easy to see videos. All you got to do is go to Greenland Climate Project, 2016 Greenland Climate Project, phase one, phase two, phase three, phase four. And you can see this boat in action, busting through ice. I guess any serious offers, I would take any serious offers. But I haven't quite made up my mind whether or not I want to sell this thing. But, you know, if someone made a good enough offer, I guess I would. Yeah, so I got half a mind to doing another long-distance single-handed trip. Being on land has been sort of making me crazy. And speaking of long-distance single-handed sailing, a friend of mine, a nice guy, Randall Reeves. He is leaving today at 1 o'clock for the figure eight. He's trying to do one of the most badass, crazy, single-handed sailing trips ever done in the history of sailing, which is basically sailing both around the Americas and around the world nonstop single-handed. Now, in his case, he's leaving from the West Coast. I think he's Golden Gate Bridge, leaving out of San Francisco, going south around Cape Horn, around the world, back around Cape Horn again, because you got to go around Cape Horn twice, then up the Atlantic, and then through the Northwest Passage, and then back down the Bering Sea and the Pacific to San Francisco. I've told him at least once, I think a couple of times now, that I think he's going the wrong way. I think it's a lot easier to leave from the East Coast and get the Northwest Passage done first, just like the route I took around the Americas. And then, once the Arctic is done, it's just blue water sailing. It's a lot of blue water sailing, and it's in some pretty rough water. But at least you don't got ice everywhere. I mean, the hardest part of sailing around... crap, hold on. Freaking heartburn. The hardest part of sailing around the Americas, for me... was the ice in the Arctic. It's just really, really hard to sleep when there's ice all over the place, and you got to time that just right. It's a lot easier to time your passage through the Northwest Passage if it's at the beginning of your trip instead of the end of your trip. So if he pulls it off, he's actually doing it in a trickier fashion, in my opinion, by leaving the Northwest Passage at the end. He's a great guy. In 2014, when I went to sail across the Pacific, doing plastics research with Nicole on the 29-foot WD Shock Harbor, the Harbor 29, right? Basically a 29-foot day sailor. We were scrambling at the dock to get that boat together. We were in Alameda Marina, and he came down one day and volunteered and helped us do quite a bit of work on that boat, and it was really nice of him. And at the time, this was 2014, he was talking to me about this figure eight, is what he's calling it, and he was talking about doing it on a West Sail 32, which I said, well, you know, I mean, it's a heavy boat, you know, it can take a lot. Not a very fast boat. Now he's upgraded quite a bit. I think he's spent a lot more money than he originally planned on spending, but he's got a much better aluminum, like 40-footer or something. And I had thought about this after I went around Cape Horn, when I was going around the Americas. At one point, I thought, well, hell, if I just keep going straight, I can also go around the world and then go back up and circumnavigate the Americas and the world. And I only thought about it seriously for probably half a day. And the reason is that my boat was falling apart around me at this point. I mean, I was going to be lucky to get back to Annapolis with that piece of, well, I hate to call an Almbega a piece of junk, but it was 40 years old, and, you know, we didn't have much money to refit it. I did my best. I mean, well, I made it back, but it didn't have enough life in it to also go around the world. I didn't think of the name Figure Eight. That was all Randall. And check it out. To follow along his trip, I'm going to be following it along. I really wish him the best of luck. I hope that he can be successful. He's a really good guy, a good human being, and I wish him all the best. And I think I'm jealous. I'm jealous as hell. I wish I was doing that. I would absolutely love to be pushing off today on a long-distance, single-handed trip. I spend the next year alone in the ocean. Sounds wonderful right now. Bring a bunch of books. I don't know, try to teach myself how to play the piano, maybe teach myself Spanish. Man, I would absolutely love a trip like that right about now. So anyways, check it out, Figure Eight. We got to cut commercial.
Bonny Las Charters is Mallorca's number one experience.
Bonny Las is a 57-foot converted fishing boat. She was built in 1949 as a herring ring netter in Scotland. And now she's set up for the Mediterranean. Apart from just relaxing in the sunshine on the deck, there's paddleboarding and any kind of exploring you can imagine up along the north coast of Mallorca here, quite often with Maggie the dog in tow as well. Bonny Las Charters is unique because no charter is really the same. We work really hard to make it the perfect day for each individual client. To be able to go out and enjoy the day with the guests on board is just fantastic.
For more information and to make a booking, visit bonnylasscharters.com.
Hello and welcome back to Ocean Research Project. I am Matt Rutherford. I probably should mention that my boat, Alt, is a Colvin Gazelle. And of course, St. Brendan is an Alban Vega. So, I don't know. I don't know if I'm really ready to sell this boat or not. I've put so much, you know, money and time into this boat and converted it into like a proper, as proper of an expedition boat as I'm going to be able to make this thing. But at the same time, you know, I don't know, maybe it's time to move on to just something different, just for the sake of it, I guess. I don't know, something a little more normal as far as sailing goes. I don't know. I don't know what to do. Make me an offer. Well, yeah. Matt@DavidWaltersYachts.com. So, well, I don't know if I pronounced that guy's name properly last time. Remus, R-I-M-E-S, I think it's spelled. You know, I apologize if I mispronounce it. I have a pretty hard time with words that I'm not familiar with. I got something called dysgraphia. I've had it since I was a kid. It just means you have a hard time reading words you're not familiar with. I've gotten a lot better over time because I've read a lot of books and, you know, but I still struggle with it. I struggle with names more than just about anything. But anyways, you know, I wish there were two different terminologies involving a rescue. Because if somebody has to fly 200 miles out in the ocean with a helicopter and pluck you off your sinking ship, then, you know, I can understand that, yeah, that's a rescue. They came out, they pulled you off your sinking ship, they saved your life, you were just rescued. But if somebody tows you, like, 30 miles into a port, I mean, I guess it's still a rescue if you can't get to that port on your own power. But it's just, you know, it's not the same situation than being plucked off your boat. You know, you still saved your boat. I don't know. Obviously, they're both still rescue. But, and then where do you draw the line in that? I mean, you know, Lynn and Larry Pardee sailed around the world on a couple of different boats that didn't have an engine. And they used to get towed into ports all the time. They certainly were not being rescued. I got towed last year about 10 miles by a boat. I had a line wrapped around my prop, and I had a small mutiny. My crew wouldn't do anything. I was, no matter how much I tried to rally the troops, they were just totally freaked out. All they could talk about was abandoning ship. I told them that I'm not going to, that they can abandon ship, but I'm not going to abandon anything. And that it's ridiculous to abandon ship just because you got a line wrapped around your prop. Even in the Arctic, where it's like 32-degree water, and you got an immersion suit. Put on your Gumby suit, pull yourself down to the prop and cut it off, you know, a couple of minutes at a time and just shift. But you got to have crew that isn't completely freaking out. So I'm sure you guys have seen now this whole rescue with these two ladies and two dogs. When I first read about it, it was just like, what? You know, and it's fairly... fairly harsh view of the situation when I first read it, because it was just like, what in the hell is this? And the media, you know, the thing is, the media, you got to understand, the media doesn't really understand sailing, so they use a lot of improper terminology, and so the first reports when people get rescued are often a bit screwy. I remember a few years ago, some guy got rescued off his boat. I don't remember all the particulars of it, but I do remember that the media saying the reason he was rescued is because he was dismasted. And when you see the picture, the mast is clearly still standing. So, you know, I mean, these journalists, they just don't know enough about sailing to be able to use proper terminology. You know, they keep calling the desalinator a water purifier. For this latest rescue. A water purifier is something like a Brita. You know, you fill it up with tap water, you put it in your refrigerator. That's a water purifier. A desalinator is a completely different monster, you know, a totally different animal. And of course, they're clueless. They have no idea. So they just report it funky. So it takes a little while for the sort of scenario to get out there. And what happened, you know, two ladies and two dogs left out of Hawaii, out of one of the islands, and on a 50-foot boat trying to go, I believe it was to Tahiti. And they had very little experience. It's really, none of this should have really happened. And I ain't trying to bash these two ladies, you know, because they went through a hell of an ordeal. And I'm, you know, I'm glad that they made it out all right. But they left right before what they claim was a Force 11 storm hit them the first day out. So there's something called passage weather. All right, if you're out in the ocean and you want a good weather forecast, the best system that I know of is to use Predict Wind in conjunction with a Iridium Go with the unlimited data package. That's your best bet for weather forecasts in the ocean. But before you leave, when you still have, you know, unlimited and infinite, you know, Wi-Fi or whatever on land, use a system, use a website called Passage Weather. Passage Weather is very easy to use. It's got very good weather forecasts. I use it before every single offshore passage. You just get online. It only takes 2 seconds. You can do it with your smartphone. Get on there, fire up Passage Weather, take a look at your region. You'll get a very good idea of what's coming for the next few days. And so the fact that they left Hawaii without even checking a weather forecast, that tells you basically all you need to know about the rest of the scenario. So they get rocked by this storm. No surprise. Force 11 is a really wicked storm. That's a survival storm. You know, anything over Force 10 is a survival storm, and which means you might not survive. I mean, you're talking about really mean ocean at that point. So they make it through, and I guess they get some damage to their spreader. They lose their engine. Their engine gets flooded. I didn't understand the story because they said it had something to do with a squall. And the squall rained a lot, and somehow it messed the starter up. I didn't understand how that could happen, but whatever. The engine broke. I mean, you know, when I was going around the Americas, the engine broke in the Pacific Ocean near the equator. I had, like, I don't know, 16,000 miles I had to do with a broken engine. You know, I forgot to tell the story when I was in Gambia. I don't know how the hell I forgot to tell this story, but my engine broke when I was 200 miles up the Gambia River. I had a crack in the heat exchanger, and there's that putty-looking stuff that's, like, green in the middle and gray on the outside, and you rub it together, and then you stick it on something like bubble gum, and it gets hard. I stuck that on the crack in the heat exchanger, and that kept my engine, stayed in place, and that's how I got back down to Gambia. I don't know how the hell I forgot to tell that story last week, but yeah, my engine broke 200 miles of the Gambia. I couldn't fix it, so I took that stuff you know, I don't remember. It's like in a long tube, you know. You rub it together, you stick it on something, and it gets hard. Anyways, a broken engine doesn't mean anything out in the ocean. And, you know, Lynn and Larry Pardee, like I mentioned earlier, they sailed around the world, like, twice without an engine at all. So, who cares? You break your engine, yeah, it sucks, you don't have your alternator, but it's not going to stop you. They had damage to a spreader, and the way they described it, now it has a 50-foot boat with a 57-foot rig, a single spreader, which is kind of surprising, because usually on a 50-foot boat, you'd have a double spreader, but whatever, single spreader rig. The spreader itself connects to the mast. There is a base that has four screws or four rivets that goes to the mast itself. And then there's the spreader tube that goes into that base. And it fits over like a sleeve. It fits over, and then you put a screw through it, and that screw holds the spreader to the base, and that base is connected to the mast. Now, if that base, all four of those rivets, or all four of those machine screws, were to fail, that would be pretty difficult to reconnect if you didn't have, you know, many parts and pieces with you. But the way they described it was the screw that holds the spreader itself to the base, which is just one screw that drops right down in it, and that's what failed. That's a super easy thing to fix. You just climb the mast and put another screw in there, and boom, it's done. So what this means, at least what I'm thinking I'm hearing, is that they had no way to climb the mast. You should always, always, always have a way to get up your mast. I have had to climb my mast in the ocean on damn near every trip I've ever done in the ocean. I haven't had to do it the last 2 years in the Arctic, but I had to do it in the Pacific. And it was vital that I could get up there. We lost our furler fell apart because it was built in the parking lot of the Alameda Marina, and they didn't put Loctite on the screws, and all the screws backed out, and so all the foils came apart basically, and I had to climb up there in the ocean while under sail with just the mainsail up and fix the furler, which was not easy. And in 2013 in the Atlantic, I had a halyard fail and I lost the mainsail, and I had to get back up there to fix something at the top of an unstayed mast. And I got this funny footage of me getting thrown around. It was really, really difficult to climb a mast, an unstayed mast with no wires to hold on to, and it was sort of slippery with salt. But and going around the Americas, I must have climbed the mast, I don't know how many times, a dozen times. When I sailed off to Europe, I climbed it. I pulled the mast on both the Pearson 323 and the Alban Vega, and I put mast steps on both of them. There's also something called an ATN mast climber. It's a great device. The ATN mast climber is a great way to get up a mast, whether you're alone or you have somebody else with you, and it doesn't rely on somebody to be strong enough to be able to winch you up for you to be able to, you know, it's sort of like a rock climbing rig that allows you to climb your mast. It's a great thing. And I've used that to climb masts also. So anyways, the long and short of it is, you got to be able to climb your mast, and you need to have spare parts. You got to have some screws. You need a bunch of machine screws, you know, a bunch of quarter 20s, just a variety of different sizes and lengths. You also need taps in case you need to tap into something to thread something. So I would suggest having at least three taps, one for quarter 20, and then get one for, you know, maybe 5/16ths and 3/16ths or something. You know, get one for quarter 20 and one larger and one smaller. Make sure you have the proper machine screws with the proper threads that go with those taps. But you never know if you're going to have to, you know, if a rivet fails on you, and rivets do fail, You can tap that hole and put a machine screw in. You can also just throw another rivet in if you want. If you have a rivet and you don't have a rivet gun, I personally would prefer, if I lose a rivet, just to tap it and screw it. I feel that a machine screw is stronger than a rivet, although I don't really know if it is or isn't. I've had this argument with riggers before, but I've seen blocks pull out of masts that have been riveted in place. I'm yet to see a block pull out of a mast that was properly tapped with a machine screw. But, you know, it's really easy to screw up a tap when you're tapping. You can tap it wrong, and those threads are not going to be very strong if you don't tap it properly. So tapping does take a little bit of practice. But nevertheless, you should have a whole bunch of machine screws. You should have a bunch of nuts and bolts and washers. And you should have a bunch of self-tapping, you know, the screws that are pointy at the end. Let's say your window gets blown out in a storm, and a whole bunch of water is coming in that window. Well, you can take something, a floorboard, the wood under a settee, something, whatever makes sense that you can rip up. You can go out there. It's going to be blowing hard. It's going to be nasty. You take your cordless drill that you always keep charged. You take some of those screws and you drill that piece of wood. You screw it into the fiberglass. It's still going to leak. It's not going to be perfect, but it's going to seriously reduce the amount of water coming in. It's going to be ugly. You're going to have a bunch of holes that you just drilled into your deck. But who cares? I mean, at the time, the important thing is to stop the water, the majority of the water, from getting into your boat. So you should always have these screws. You should always have a way to get up your mast, and you should always have a bunch of extra screws, both machine screws, nuts, bolts. It's just, the rig is so incredibly important. And, you know, in this case, you shouldn't go out to sea right before a Force 11 storm. Obviously, they weren't paying any attention to the weather. And, and you should be able to get up your mast and do a simple repair, like putting a screw in place, taking out a screw and replacing one screw. I mean, the whole thing should never have stopped them. It's really good that they had all the extra food, and I guess when the one lady talked to the other lady before they left, the captain or the owner of the boat said something about, I have no idea what's going to happen to us out there, and that's why they got all this extra food. And the other girl said something along the lines of, I've never sailed before. Like, that's okay, because I've never sailed before. I really feel for that girl. You know, can you imagine that? You've never sailed before in your life, and the first time you go sailing is on this 50-foot boat with this person who she had a lot of admiration. There certainly wasn't any animosity between them, and there really shouldn't be animosity between them, because they both survived this situation, luckily for them. But can you imagine that being your first sailing experience, getting stuck on a boat for 5 months? I mean, that's just crazy. And I guess the lady spent 2 years fixing this boat up, and she said something about getting the rigging changed around, but they wouldn't have changed that screw out. And it could also be, you could also use a cotter pin, clevis pin, I'm sorry. A clevis pin with a cotter in it could also work in place of a screw. But, the whole situation is, and then there's all this stuff about sharks biting fiberglass hulls, tiger sharks. I've seen a lot of sharks in the ocean. I've never heard of sharks biting a fiberglass hull. Unless there's some blood in the water. I don't know. I mean, it might sound weird to say, but it's possible if one of them was having their period and they're flushing toilet straight overboard, it could have put a little blood in the water, and that could have aggravated the sharks, and that could have potentially had them attack the boat. But I've never heard of it happening before, although I'm not saying it's impossible. Actually, there was one old story from a long time ago that I did hear something along these lines, but I'll tell you guys in a minute. I got to go to commercial break.
Our aim at Street Invest is to put a trustworthy adult into the lives of street children so that they can support them in creating the most positive paths for their lives in the future. We work around the world, working on the street with the children where they are. For such a large group of children, the amount of funding available is tiny. really the funding that keeps organisations like Street Invest going comes from individual donors. Street children are the most abused, neglected, violated children, yet they're also the most resourceful, responsive and resilient children that we could have the honour of working with.
For more information or to make a donation, visit streetinvest.org.
This is Bob Bitchin from Cruising Outpost Magazine, and I love listening to Boat Radio.
Hello, and welcome back to Ocean Research Project. I'm Matt Rutherford, sitting on the Alt. So to get back to the story, Richard Henderson wrote a book called Single-Handed Sailing some time ago. Richard Henderson, he wrote 12 or 15 books about sailing, something like that. I think he passed away a few years ago. He kicked off his writing career with a book called East to the Azores, where he gets hit by this Force 10 storm with his family when he's trying to sail to the Azores, and he uses the heavy weather tactic of lying a haul, which means you just drop all your sails and sort of let your boat go with it, which is a horribly uncomfortable way to make it through a storm. I mean, they made it through. They made it through without getting too much damage, but... That would be like the last way that I would want to weather a storm. But anyways, he wrote a good book called Single-Handed Sailing. And in this book, it starts off with a series of stories about sort of the old school days, you know, the old days of single-handed sailing. One of the stories is about the first, it's one of the first, if it's not the very first, it's one of the first single-handed races across the Atlantic in like, I don't know, 1890 or something like that, a long time ago. And, one guy does talk about, he's on a little like 21 foot wooden boat with a stern hung rudder. And one day he hears this crunching noise and he looks out and there's a shark chewing on his stern hung rudder. And for whatever reason, he had an explosive device with him. I guess it was a lot easier to get dynamite back then. I guess it wasn't very regulated. And so he basically threw like some dynamite overboard or something and he blew up the shark, but... He damaged his boat more than the shark could have ever damaged his boat. You know, he probably could have just poked the shark a couple times with a knife or something, or a knife, you know, tie a knife to a boat hook. I don't know if he had a boat hook back then. Who knows? It just seems like there'd be a better way to get rid of a shark than throwing TNT at it, as the TNT might blow you up too. But anyways, that's the only other story I've ever heard. It was a much smaller boat, like 21 feet. I've seen a lot of sharks in the ocean. They typically haven't had any concern, but I don't know. Whatever. I'm not saying that it couldn't happen. Then another time they talk about a 10 knot current that pushed them backwards. I mean, you normally don't get that kind of current out in the ocean. I mean, there's one place off the Channel Islands. I don't know if it's Jersey. The Channel Islands are located between France and England. Below southwest England, and there's a place called The Race, and The Race, you can have like 8 or 9 knot currents, but that's a tide driven current. It's very, you know, it's in the English Channel, it's between the coast of France and these islands, so it's pretty, you know, pretty close proximity to land, and that's one of the strongest currents that I know of. There are a few other places with strong currents, but typically out in the more open ocean, the Gulf Stream is a great example of a strong current. But even at its max, you usually don't get more than 4 knots. So, you know, a 10 knot current is probably an overstatement, I would think. And I don't know. I mean, why didn't they have an EPIRB? I mean, you got enough money to have a 50 foot boat. Why in the world don't you have an EPIRB? I mean, that would have ended the situation right there and then. You know, you'd pull it out and boom, you get rescued. Why were they so far off course? They said they could still sail something like 4 knots. When I went around the Americas, I averaged 3.6 knots over 309 days. So at 3.6 knots, you can still keep your boat on course. I mean, it takes longer to get there, but you can still get to wherever it is you're trying to go. They were lost at sea. I mean, don't you got a GPS? I don't know. I just, everything to me is points that, you know, leaving before a storm, not being able to get up and fix your spreader, which is a really easy fix if it's just one screw that has broken. I don't, you know, your engine breaks, but that doesn't really matter if your engine breaks in the ocean. I mean, you might have to get towed in when you get to whatever island you're going to. I got towed into Bermuda one time. I just met the pilot boat at a marker. They said, be at this channel marker at this time, and I was there waiting for them, and they threw me a line, and they pulled me in. They said they were damaged by the towboat, by a fishing boat that tried to tow them. Absolutely. You got to be careful when being towed by a much bigger vessel. You really shouldn't be towed more than hull speed. Anything more than hull speed is going to add a lot of load to your boat. I think in Bermuda they towed me at about 8-9 knots, which was pretty damn fast. But I got a steel boat, and so that I was connected to a big steel Samson post. So it didn't put that much strain. On a fiberglass boat, I think the loads are going to be a little different. But, you know, the long and short of it is, you know, I'm glad they're rescued. I think this is an example of why, you know, you should check the weather before you go out to sea. If there's a storm coming, don't go out until the storm has passed. You should have a way to get up your rig. You know, you really should think about how you're going to build a jury rig, you know, also in case you lose your mast completely. Even losing your mast completely is not enough of a reason to be lost at sea like this. You know, Lisa Blair, I talked about her before. She sailed around Antarctica single-handed. She lost her rig. I think she was 600 miles south of South Africa. She didn't have enough fuel to motor back. She only had like 200 miles of diesel or something like that. So she built a jury rig and slowly sailed back to South Africa. And that's what you do. So even if your entire mast falls down, you should still be able to you know, build something to get you back. It might not be pretty, it might not be fast, you know, but so yeah, I don't know. It's sort of a crazy story. This sort of stuff happens though. People go out to sea that really shouldn't be going out to sea. And in this case, they almost died. And the last part is the dogs. This was poor planning, because most countries are very, very unfriendly to you bringing animals into their country. Some countries are okay with it, like the Bahamas. In the Bahamas, you can show up with your dogs. You can show up with your dogs and your pistol. For whatever, it's funny, in the Bahamas, if you're a citizen, you're not allowed to own a pistol. But for some reason, if you're from the United States, you can sail there with a pistol. I never understood that. But anyways, dogs, cats, freaking monkeys, whatever it is, if you show up, a lot of these countries will quarantine them. So don't think you can go sailing off with your dog and it's going to be all good. There, you must check first. Just like a gun. I mean, it's that serious. It's they're not going to throw you in jail for showing up with a dog like they might with a gun. So it's not legally as serious. But it's as serious in the sense that they're going to be very unhappy if they see that dog. There's a lot of times where they'll take that dog away from you and they'll put it in quarantine. And some of these countries, that's going to be a really nasty kennel for that dog to be in. And in other places, they'll just straight up euthanasia that dog. They'll just straight kill it. So, you know, it's a really bad idea to try to sail around the world with dogs unless you've been very careful ahead of time to figure out which countries you can go to and can't go to. And you have to be okay with your dog potentially going into quarantine in some of these countries. And the quarantine can be months long, you know, like 6 months, 3 months. I mean, the quarantine period can be a long time. So the fact that they had a couple of dogs with them and they're trying to sail off to Tahiti, which I don't know the rules in Tahiti, but my guess is they probably are not very happy if you show up with a foreign animal. They don't like it if you show up with fruit, let alone a foreign animal. So, you know, I think across the board, this was just, you know, just completely inexperienced or fairly inexperienced people. And, you know, I'm not trying to chastise them or bash them or anything like that. I'm really glad that everything worked out in the end. I really feel for that other woman who had never been sailing before because she didn't know any better. They both seem to be joking around and getting along, and that's great. I'm glad nobody is pointing fingers and blaming each other. I'm glad everybody is smiling and just saying, you know, I'm glad, you know, I'm happy we made it through. I'm happy we're still in one piece. But, you know, there's plenty of examples where people, I don't know, the ocean is a serious place, you know, and sailing itself is pretty easy. Raising your sails, lowering your sails, reefing your sails, sail trim, all that stuff is fairly easy and fairly straightforward. The hard part about blue water sailing really isn't the sailing as much as it is you need to have an intimate understanding of all the systems on your boat, you know, which means the engine, which means your plumbing, your wiring, your rig. You need to be able to fix everything. I'm not saying every last single thing. I mean, we are human after all. We're only going to be able to fix so many things on our boat. But all the important stuff, you know, if you have rudder failure and it's just like your quadrant, say like a chain, you got a chain going to your quadrant that goes to a wire and that chain failed or the wire failed or, you know, and you need to have a lot of backup, like spare lines and, you know, it's just whatever spares you can possibly muster, you know, and there's, like I said, there's only so much you can do and, you know, things are going to break in the ocean that you can't fix. So you just got to live to learn. You got to learn to live without them. You know, that's really your only choice. Either you fix it or you learn to live without it. Or you quit. And, you know, quitting can be fine as long as you're not trying to do some big single-handed trip. If you're doing some big single-handed trip around the world or the figure eight or around the Americas, then quitting is not really an option. You just need to learn to live without it. But it's important to learn the systems on your boat. And I think that it takes more time to learn the systems, and it's a lot more complicated than just simply being able to raise your sails, lower your sails, the storm tactics. Navigation can be a bit complicated. That takes a little bit of time to learn. But I think that understanding the systems on your boat is something that's just as important, because they're going to break. It's the ocean. You know, stuff is going to break, and you're going to want to be able to fix it. Especially if it's relatively simple stuff. So yeah, you know, it's... So I don't have a whole lot of time left to get back into the story, the Europe, Africa, Caribbean story. I can't believe I forgot to talk about my heat exchanger breaking 200 miles up the Gambia. But like I said, I just put some of that putty stuff on it, and that held until, you know, I got across the ocean. I didn't use... I think I had a 30-gallon tank on that boat, and I used, the first time I sailed alone across the Atlantic in 34 days, I used 16 gallons of diesel, and the second time I used 6 gallons. I didn't use much because, you know, the second time I was kind of worried about the engine because that heat exchanger crack and all that other stuff, and then I had problems. The engine just got worse and worse over time. And I showed up in Antigua, I crossed the second single-handed transatlantic was like a 5-minute story last week. There really wasn't much to say, you know, to talk about it, because it's an easy crossing. I know a guy who sailed around the world with a girlfriend. He spent 3 years sailing around the world. He did it on a West Sail 32. I met this guy years ago before I did any, when I was just getting into sailing, and back when I thought sailing around the world was this really big deal. And now I realize that if you do the barefoot route, you know, you basically stay near the equator, you do the two canals, the Suez Canal and the Panama Canal, that it's really not, although it's still a lot of sailing, you know, the ARC Rally has been doing that for years, and they have a lot of data from years and years and years of weather reports. And if you do that route, it's something like less than 1% of the time it blows over 30 knots. Because you're near the equator, and if you're there at the right time of year, you don't have to be right by. When I say near the equator, I mean within, you know, 1,500, 2,000 miles of the equator, you know, on either side of the equator. So it's a pretty big area. But if you're there at the right time of year, you're going to get some pretty nice winds. And obviously you can't be near the equator all the time because of the land mass of Asia and Europe and Africa and that whole thing. You got where, but anyways, the crossing that... The moral of this story I'm trying to tell is I asked this guy, when I was first getting into sailing, you know, I wanted to do blue water sailing. I wanted to do long distance offshore stuff, cross oceans and all that. So I asked everybody I could find with experience, like every question I could, and, until they got tired of me asking them questions. Every old salt I could find, I just questioned, you know, I hit them all these different questions. Eventually they got tired of the questions, you know, but I needed information. So this guy, I said, oh, what was it like crossing the Atlantic? And he was like, well, from Canaries to Caribbean, I don't really remember anything about that crossing. I just remember that I read a few books. And that's it, because there's really nothing to remember. That's a really straightforward crossing. I mean, some people have a hard time with it. Stephen Callahan sunk and spent 76 days in a life raft. He had a real hard time of it. But generally speaking, it's a pretty straightforward, easy crossing. And so, yeah, I guess I didn't have a whole lot to say about it because, you know, just not much really happened that me spent 28 days in the ocean. But I did wind up in Antigua, and I was running out of money. I only had like 20-some bucks when I showed up, so I had to get over to the U.S. Virgin Islands so I could work without a work visa. And that's where I'll get into next week or next time, whenever I do one of these again. I also work for David Walters Yachts. If you need any help trying to find a good blue water boat, there's a lot of boats out there, and you don't want to be the one who dumps all the money into the boat. It's much better to buy a boat that the previous person has dumped all the money into, unless you like a project. And if you like a project, you can buy St. Brendan, the boat that went around the Americas. Or maybe, hey, buy this boat. Everything's for sale. I don't know if I'm going to sell my motorcycle. You want a 1977 Harley Sportster? I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do right now about a lot of things. But anyways, check out oceanresearchproject.org. You can make donations. Check out the Greenland Climate Project 2016. Greenland Climate Project Phase 1 to Phase 4. Those are the videos from last week. You can go to PBS. Go to Google. And Google Red Dot in the Ocean, PBS, and you'll find the film about my trip around the Americas on PBS. It was nominated for an Emmy at one point. I guess, yeah. And there you go. Have a good weekend, and talk to you guys soon. All right, bye.
With a plan to expand my vision, yeah, it's either this or it's prison. I'm trying to be free and expand my wisdom. I gotta tell my story. I did it for the journey, the glory. Many men tried way before me. I had to do it bigger cause I had to make history. From the streets to the sea, far away, not a soul did I see. From Chesapeake up to Baffin Bay, my motto is hard work first and laugh and play. Now let's take a trip through the Northwest Passage. Some say I got a problem, I say it's a passion. I'm just trying to reach my goals before passing, and I'ma do what I wanna do without asking. It's my life, my right, so I fight for my dreams, no matter how hard it might seem. This is my pipe dream. My advice to get your mind right, find light and do the right thing, no matter the weather or whatever the night brings. Thunder and lightning, it's enlightening. Lost in the abyss, I can't even begin to explain how awesome this is. I've been all around the world and back, around the world, to find myself, to reach my goals, to find my dreams. When I'm away, to wash away, I explore. I've been all around the world and back, around the world, to find myself, to reach my goals, to find my dreams. When I'm away, to wash away, I explore. I've been all around the world and back, all around the world and back, all around the world and back. I've been all around the world and back, world and back, world and back. I've been all around the world and back, all around the world and back, all around the world and back. I've been all around the world and back, world and back, world and back. I've been all around the world and back. Back in the days I used to do
it for gold. It was a mission to get rich, I do it for soul. They thought that I was a misfit, it would probably fall. But I'm the type to go the distance and finish the brawl. They said that it was suicide, that I would die for sure. But I was like the prince of tide in the eye of a storm. Yo, the great waves, they send sailors crashing. You're on the map, I'm on the face of the atlas. Thousands of miles away, I'm trying to see the world while you sit at home, probably doing the same thing. The fact that you don't want to get out and explore is a damn shame. It's either you're too lazy to do it or you just can't hang. Trendsetter, major sailor, the vendetta, breaking the world record, no one can do it better. There's so much in the world you must see, and you can make a big difference, just you and me. Now I've been all around the world and back, around the world, to find myself, to reach my goals, to find my dreams. When I'm away, to wash away, I explore. I've been all around the world and back, around the world, to find myself, to reach my goals, to find my dreams. When I'm away, to wash away, I explore. I've been all around the world and back.
When you're ready to escape, but your boat's not ship shape, that's okay. Skipper's review will get you on your way. Marina's mechanic, satellites, and crew. Skippersreview.com will find it for you. Friends will tell you which ones to use in just a few words with their glowing reviews. Skippersreview.com, where boaters know best and businesses pass the test.
Boat Radio is brought to you by Boomridge.com, the home of adventure.